This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
We were just chatting before I pressed record about Trump, and you were suggesting that there's something going on, not just with the JFK files, but with the moon landing files.
Yeah. So I've given this some thought, and what's very interesting about Trump is he's usually, he's bombastic, he's very direct. But when it comes to the Apollo moon landings, he's not as direct as I would like him to be. But he did, in my opinion, throw down the gauntlet with NASA back in his previous administration, back was it 2018 and 19, his last year in office, when he challenged NASA to put another manned landing on the moon. And he gave them to 2024. So here we are, 2025. Not only has it been pushed back once, again, it's been pushed back a second time. Now it's been pushed back a third time. So now we're looking at maybe as early as 2026. So my feeling about this is, my sense is that he's going to do this again. And it's a form, in my opinion, of him chastising NASA. You did it 55 years ago. Can you do it in 2024? Well, the answer came back, no. Can you do it in 2025? No. So now we're waiting for 2026. So I think the thing with the Apollo moon missions, the reason why he's not so direct is he knows the emotional attachment that people have to this subject. And that emotional attachment crosses all party lines, all ideologies. So I think he's being careful. I'm no fan of Trump, to be honest with you, but I kind of do like what I like the atmosphere now than it was, let's say, 5 years ago. I like where we are. And if anything, he's whether he's done it purposely or whether he's done it inadvertently, he has certainly got us talking. He's got everybody talking. And this is the conversation I've been wanting to have in general for decades. Now we're here. Now we're seeing it. That part is good. So I think that's what he's up to.
But do you think he believes man went to the moon?
No, I don't think he does. If Trump, if anything, is not stupid. I mean, he's people can say what they want about Trump. I say it too. I wouldn't have voted for him. I wouldn't have voted for any of them. I just don't vote anymore. I don't like it. It serves no purpose because of the way the system is. That said, you've got to give him credit for the fact that he's shaking it up. Whether he's doing it for his own means, his own selfish means, I don't know. Personally, I don't care. But he has us talking. And I do, and he's not stupid. He built a $1 billion company, a real estate company, so he's not a stupid man. So I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's approaching the Apollo moon missions with kid gloves. I think it's, if I can use that old saying, baby steps, I think that's what he's doing. Because he, as I said earlier, he knows the emotional attachment to this. And I get it. I get that emotional attachment. I come across it all the time. I've taken a lot of abuse online. I've been threatened. I've had people say, I know where you live. It's all part and parcel to what I'm involved in. I knew this going in anyway. So, I don't lose a lot of sleep over, but I get the emotional attachment. And it is important for people like myself and for others that work in this, in my community, that work on this type of research, that we do not mock that emotional attachment. They're going to have to get there themselves. Right. So I think it's a lot more complex than most people realize. I know people will say Trump should come out and just say it. I don't think it's that easy. I don't think it's that easy. But I think we're on that path.
How many presidents do you think actually do believe it?
None, unless they're incredibly stupid. I'm still surprised that many people believe it. When you look at the technological aspect of it, just from that point of view alone. There are other aspects of it that we can discuss too, but when you look at the technological aspects of the Apollo moon missions, you look where we are today, it still boggles my mind. And I'm not an engineer. I mean, I'm a pilot by trade, but I'm not an engineer. But you don't have to be an engineer to look at this stuff. You can research this for yourself, and you can also approach it with some common sense. We do not, 55 years ago, we did not have the technological capability of landing manned missions on the moon. We don't have it today. We don't have it at all. So it surprises me that still there are so, not as many as before, but there's still so many people that hang on to the belief that we landed manned missions on the moon because of their emotional attachment.
Mm. Well, let's kind of go through your book. And you start off with a chapter called Strange Detour, and you mentioned somebody called Jack Parsons.
Yes.
Tell me more about him.
Yeah, now that's another. See, I just mentioned earlier different aspects of the Apollo missions. So, and I wanted to emphasize that point with your audience, that my books, 90% of my books focus on the technological challenges of sending a manned mission to the moon. So I want that established because what we're going to get into now, people tend to scoff at. So I just want that established. But there is no denying this other aspect to NASA. Now, to give a little background on Jack Parsons, Jack Parsons was a rocket scientist back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Jack Parsons developed a lot of the theories and methods that are used today in NASA's propulsion systems, and they're, you know, basically as it pertains to propulsion. So, for example, solid fuel boosters and liquid fueled rocket engines, and that was his big thing. The interesting thing about Jack Parsons is that he had no education above high school. He was not college or university educated. He had no higher ability in terms of math, so he had no ability to use calculus, which is very important when it comes to rocket science. But yet somehow he managed to come out with all these theories, and they were validated by mathematicians at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, right? Now here's where it gets very interesting. Jack Parsons was no ordinary scientist. I mean, if you look at photos of Jack Parsons, he looks like a movie star. Okay, he just has that look about him. He's not your typical science, you know, with a chalkboard in a classroom. He just doesn't have that look. The other thing that's very interesting about Jack Parsons is that he literally, and I mean literally, and I'm like literally, he read an article one day in a local newspaper about a scientist at Caltech. And he was talking about, you know, sending rockets into space. At that time, it was unheard of. And this is like 1930s, 1940s. He literally walked into the California Institute of Technology, sought out this scientist who was talking, who wrote the article, and he wanted to expand on the rocket technology he was talking about. Long story short, he ends up, this is a man with no academic background, and I don't put any credence into academic backgrounds by any stretch. I mean, I think people are smart with or without it, but we're just talking within the context of, you know, normie land, if I could put it that way, right? So here's an individual who walks into Caltech. A year later, he not only has his own office, he's not only part of the staff, he has his own laboratory, and he has his own scientific team. I find that very unusual, that a person can literally walk in from the streets, Jack Parsons, and a year later, he has tenure at California Institute of Technology. Now, it gets even better. Jack Parsons was heavily involved in the occult. He had a lot of correspondence with Aleister Crowley. Now, for those of you who don't know Aleister Crowley, I'm sure you do. Aleister Crowley ran basically a Church of Satan. He was very popular in Britain among celebrities, among the power elite. You'll find Aleister Crowley's image on the cover of the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And you'll also find out that Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin lives in his mansion. Okay, so that's how connected Aleister Crowley was back in the 1930s and 1940s. This is an individual that Jack Parsons was communicating with on a regular basis and started his own chapter in the United States while working on at Caltech. And it turns out now that many of these scientists at Caltech, physicists and mathematicians, were also part of this elite satanic club that Jack Parsons was involved in. Now, it gets even deeper. You're familiar with Wernher von Braun?
Yes. He worked with the Nazis.
Yes. So Wernher von Braun was a rocket scientist. He famously built the I think it's the V2 rocket that supposedly terrorized Britain during World War II. He was brought over after World War II. He was brought over to the United States by the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA. And he was recruited into their space program and eventually recruited into NASA when it was brought into being by Eisenhower in 1958.
Mm. Wasn't he part of Operation Paperclip? He was in that file, yes. I think. Yes.
Yes, yes. And I believe now that the proper Operation Paperclip was a secret. There was a deal going on between them and, of course, the Soviet Union. They took their scientists, and of course the Americans took theirs. But what's very interesting about this whole connection with Wernher von Braun is it turns out that Jack Parsons was in constant communication by telephone to Wernher von Braun in the 1930s and 1940s, as well as the 1950s. So for people out there, just think about that for a second. He was in telephone conversations with Wernher von Braun before World War II, during World War II, and of course, after World War II. The question is, why was he in constant contact with Wernher von Braun? This scientist who's spent half his time working on theories, rocket theories, and half his time dabbling into the occult, the world of the occult. And it turns out that all of the people that are by this time were working in the rocket space program, which was under NASA at that time, had to be checked out by the FBI. So they had to have security clearances from the FBI and presumably later by the CIA. While all this is going on, this is all going on under the eyes of the FBI. So Wernher von Braun was a force in the United States and their space program long before he was brought over to the United States under Operation Paperclip, and the close ties between him and Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley. You see where this is going?
Very occultic is where it's going.
Yeah, yeah, very occultic. And that's the part that I want to bring this around to, is that what people don't understand is, and I believe this strongly now, when it comes to NASA's space program, I'm beginning to see now, aside from the technological aspects and challenges of getting to the moon, that is getting a manned mission to the moon. I'm not talking about all manned missions. And I want to just clarify that. We're talking about an agency that is based and bathed
on Satanism,
the occult. Mm. Yeah, exactly. And you can see it on its symbolisms. You can see it in the Apollo missions. You can see it everywhere you look. If you open your eyes, if you want to go down that rabbit hole, you'll see it. It becomes abundantly clear. It gets to the point where you cannot ignore it. You cannot not see it, is what I'm saying.
Now, NASA don't like to talk about Jack Parsons.
No, and that's the interesting thing about this. Now, Jack Parsons was killed in 1952, supposedly in one of his own experiments. That I have read a lot about that and is not really being determined. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. I also now beginning to, I spoke a little bit glowingly of him in my book, the first chapter of my second book. I'm sort of now looking at that and realizing there's a lot more going on with Jack Parsons. It baffles me to this day how he can come up with the theories. Well, actually, it can happen. It's happened in history. And the mathematicians would come up with the solutions. He would present the theories. So Jack Parsons basically had the solutions, and the mathematicians would work the equations out to come up with that solution. So to validate that solution, rather. So I don't know. It really amazes me how deep down the rabbit hole this occult is. And that seems to be what NASA is. There's a lot of NASA themes about this. And Jack Parsons has been credited with the success of the so-called Apollo moon missions and the space shuttle after NASA was enacted by Eisenhower in 1958. Now, here's the thing. Jack Parsons he built the JPL Laboratories, that's Jet Propulsion Laboratories, and they celebrate that every year. They still celebrate to this day Jack Parsons. NASA's very, very quiet about it. They don't like to make a lot of fanfare, but it's a ritual. and it's part of their ritual. And that's what every year there's a celebration on the contribution that Jack Parsons made to the technology that NASA uses. So he's a very important figure, although the average person wouldn't know that.
So he's part of the proto Apollo mission, if I can use that terminology. But then let's go to the next stage, which is the pre Apollo mission.
Yeah, so I looked into the missions before the Apollo mission. So I looked into the Mercury program, I looked into the Gemini program, and then I looked into their unmanned satellite programs. And they were sending, missions to unmanned missions to map the moon, supposedly, of course, to pick out landing areas for the Apollo missions. And of course, there was supposed to be 7. Turns out there was only 6 because one of them had an accident on the way there and back. So what I realized is that they were mapping the moon not for an actual manned mission. They were mapping the moon as closely as possible to get as much definition as possible to build replicas for the filming of the moon missions on Earth. That's exactly what those missions are about. And here's another interesting thing too, is that the unmanned mission started off plagued with problems, and which is understandable because it was new technology in the early 1960s. And it still was plagued with problems. Even to this day, it's plagued with problems. Like, you know, unmanned missions, you have a 40% failure rate among unmanned missions. But lo and behold, you have an almost 100% a 100% success rate almost when it comes to manned missions. So it's interesting how that works, where the technology to send unmanned missions to the moon, a lot more basic than it would be to send manned missions to the moon. And because you have to factor in environmental controls and all that to keep people alive. Yet the unmanned mission technology was, you know, had 40% failure rate versus the manned missions, which pretty well had a 100% success rate. That's with the Apollo missions, not counting the two supposed accidents with the space shuttle. But when you factor in, they had basically a 95% rate. Interesting how that works.
Talk to me a little bit now about the process of the Apollo mission and how they got to it. Because, I mean, it was announced, I think, in 63, I think.
Yeah, so it was announced actually about a year before that, when John F. Kennedy made his famous speech to the United Nations, you know, we're going to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. I think he quickly realized that that wasn't going to happen, and I think he made some hints on that too before he was assassinated. But so the whole plan was that was the whole point of the Mercury missions. Remember, when they made this decision to go to the moon, the Russians had already sent up their first cosmonaut who actually did a full orbit around the Earth. So they were already ahead of the United States when it came to not only their unmanned missions, but their manned missions. So then when Kennedy made this famous speech, they had a total of 15 minutes experience in a suborbital flight with Mercury. That was the extent of their experience. So they had to go from a 15-minute suborbital flight, not even a full orbit, to landing a man on the moon. And the technological challenges alone in just getting the necessary hardware into low Earth orbit in and of itself would have been a major challenge. And I actually now realize that in order to have sent a manned mission to the moon, you would be talking about spending trillions of dollars just getting the right apparatus in orbit to use that as a launching pad. You can't do it from Earth. You can't do it from launch pad. It's just not possible. So this became, of course, a fairy tale early on. So this is where Wernher von Braun comes in. Wernher von Braun was tasked with, he was assigned the Saturn program. So it was the Saturn rocket that was used to launch the Apollo missions to the moon. Now, I want to clarify something here. There's two rockets that were used in the Apollo program. There was the Saturn 1B. Saturn 1B was a far less powerful rocket. And then there's the Saturn V. Saturn V was the most powerful rocket ever built. And that was the one that was used supposedly to launch manned missions to the moon. Without that Saturn V rocket and without its brand new all-powerful F1 engines, those missions would not have happened. Okay. And that's where my research came in when I looked at those engines and realized the problems that they have. Now, there is one Apollo mission that I'm leaving open to the possibility that did happen, that was real, and that was Apollo 7. Apollo 7 was a low Earth orbit mission only. That was to test the command module. That used the Saturn 1B rocket. It did not use the Saturn V. So the Saturn 1B rocket, you know, they had, you know, numerous launches before they put a crew on board. It was, in my opinion, it was not only the static testing that was adequate, but I think, you know, in terms of the practical in-flight testing for the Saturn 1B, the less powerful rocket, was very adequate, you know, given the cost involved in this. Now, compare that to the Saturn V. So the Saturn V rocket was used for the Apollo missions to land on the moon. It had only two. Now, it had a lot of static testing. So I know the viewer will come back and say, no, they had a lot of testing. They're right. Had a lot of static testing. For those out there, static testing means just testing the engines on the ground. So you bolt the engines down and you fire the engines and you know, check the data and you record that data, so on and so forth. But you need a comparable amount of in-flight testing. And they launched two, Apollo 4 and Apollo 6, both Saturn V missions, both unmanned to test them to see if they worked. One worked, apparently. The other one was a near disaster. And on that basis alone, they launched the first crew on a Saturn V rocket. So basically what they did was, is I can bottom line this by saying it this way. They launched, they put a crew on board the Saturn V rocket. This was with Apollo 8. With a total of 2 minutes of in-flight testing of their brand new, all-powerful F1 engines, which you'll find in the first stage of the Saturn V. It's a three-stage rocket. You need the F1 engines because you needed the F1 engines to produce that enormous amount of power to lift the Apollo hardware into low Earth orbit, to get it just in, to get it into low Earth orbit for its proper trajectory to the moon. So if you don't have those F1 engines working right, you have no Apollo moon missions. And that's exactly what Bill Kaysing said. He was the pioneer in this back 40, 50 years ago. He worked on the F1 engines in the late 1950s and 1960s. And when he saw what was going on with the F1 engines and that data was being falsified, he resigned in 1963. And then he wrote his book about this in 1977. And he said the same thing. What you're watching there with the Saturn V rockets is, number one, it's a stripped-down version of the Saturn V. It's not using the F1 engines. Keep in mind, the F1 engines, anybody can look this up, the F1 engines that were used in the Apollo program were the most powerful engines ever built, and according to NASA, the most successful. Yet, look at today.
How do they compare to...
We can't get that kind of power into orbit.
Okay, so how do they compare to SpaceX rockets today?
Yeah, well, SpaceX rockets use less power, and they use engines that are comparable to what was being used in the Saturn 1B, which I said was fairly successful, which is the less powerful rocket. So let's look at Artemis. Artemis is using the space shuttle engines, which have been used for 30 years. And they're using the same booster technology that they've used in Saturn V, and it supposedly produces a lot more power than the Saturn V did. Now, that, but that tells me something else, because look at the problems we're having with the Artemis program, with their attempt. That was Trump's gauntlet he threw down, and their NASA's response was Artemis. They were going to, they built a new version of the Apollo command module. It's just a new version of it. It's slightly bigger, but it's the same design. And I think they've had two launches, if I'm not mistaken. I know they had one launch where they sent Artemis to the moon. And they had dummies on board, and put humans on board, of course. And that data is being classified. Why? Why are they classifying data? I mean, it's amazing to me, and they haven't had a launch in several years, and they postponed the launch of the Artemis. Trump laid down the gauntlet, and he said, put a man on the moon, back on the moon by 2024. NASA couldn't comply with that, so they pushed it to 2025. Now they pushed it to 2026. We're talking one mission. In 8 years since the launch of Artemis, in 8 years since just one launch, that apparently has trouble, and a mission that they classified, NASA supposedly launched, 6, 7, 8, 9 successful Apollo missions in 8 years. But NASA can't do one in 8 years. And that's where we are today, using the same technology, that was used 55 years ago. Here's what I would advise NASA. If I was working for NASA, I'd say, why don't you go back to 1969, 55 years, and reverse engineer the technology we're using then, because it obviously worked perfectly, because you're not having any success today.
Yeah, but
that's where we're at.
The argument would be, but it wasn't climate friendly.
It wasn't what?
It wasn't climate friendly, or it wasn't efficient or fuel efficient or whatever the excuses are.
Yeah, DEI and all that, of course. And then there are other excuses that they're not getting the funding that they did. Let me clarify something here for the folks out there. NASA is still getting half the funding it got 55 years ago for its Apollo missions. With that funding, they were able to put supposedly 6 manned missions on the moon, okay, with Apollo 11, 12, 13. 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. Okay. NASA, with half the funding, which is still a substantial amount of money, can't land one mission on the moon with the same technology that they used 55 years ago.
Now, back in the 60s, Randy, you mentioned one person who resigned, but were there engineers involved in the project that saw something was very wrong?
Yeah. Actually, it's a very interesting point you bring up. I can't think of their names right now, but it is in my book, my second book as well. I documented a couple of engineers who worked on the Apollo space program, and they today looking back on that and say they're dismayed at the lack of quality control within the Apollo program. What a lot of people don't understand is that there was a fatality with the Apollo program, with Apollo 1. That wasn't an actual launch. That was a simulated launch. So they were simulating a launch, and they were supposed to be the first crew that would land on the moon. Leading that crew was a man by the name of Gus Grissom. Gus Grissom was very outspoken about the Apollo program himself. During the Apollo program, before, of course, the accident, he had famously hung a lemon on the command module simulator during a live press interview, and that upset a lot of management within NASA, because he was indicating to, and it made headlines, and he was indicating to the world that we're going to be flying to the moon in a lemon. And it was interesting that 2 weeks later, he, along with two other, two other astronauts in the Apollo 1 simulation were killed in a fire. And they couldn't get them out. And he's the most obvious one. Now, here's where it gets even more disturbing. He was very vocal about that. He knew that. He famously said before he died in the fire, how do we expect to get to the moon if we can't communicate here on Earth between two buildings? Okay. And because during the simulation, because they're having communication problems. 2 weeks later, North American Aviation Quality Control Inspector Thomas Barron testified before Congress about the disturbing aspects of the quality control that was going on at NASA. He submitted a 50-page report. Actually, he submitted a 50-page report and then spoke, I think, for a couple of hours to congressional members in a hearing. And then he submitted a 500-page report. After that, a week later, he was killed along with his family in a railroad crossing, what was called an accident. But I find it a little too coincidental that you have the Apollo 1 crew dead, killed in a fire. 3 weeks later, you have the safety inspector for North American Aviation who built the equipment for the Apollo program. He turns up dead. And then his 500-page report to Congress goes missing. To this day, it's still missing. So you see, you have a lot of very interesting aspects going on here. I know it's a lot.
A lot of things have gone missing, including the original tapes.
Yeah. Well, there's a very interesting story about that. Do you want to hear that?
Yes.
So movie director Ron Howard, very good producer, director. I like some of his movies. He famously made the Apollo 13 movie about the so-called accident So in 2009, he came up with the idea of commemorating the 40th anniversary of the first mission to land on the moon, Neil Armstrong, with Apollo 11, and he wanted to make a documentary. So what he did, he contacted NASA, and he asked NASA for the telemetry tapes, because what he wanted to do was to, just excuse me for a second here, Jerm. Okay, so what he wanted to do was he wanted the telemetry tapes, the original telemetry tapes, for his movie. He didn't just want to do a documentary. He wanted to do it in IMAX. And what he needed was the original telemetry tapes to access the original video feed that was used to, you know, photograph, film them on the moon. So, and the telemetry tapes, for people who don't know, the telemetry tapes contain three more important pieces of information. That is the medical data for the astronauts, the telemetry for the spacecraft, and the visual feed that everybody supposedly saw, that we all saw live back in 1969. So, very good idea, except there was one problem. NASA came back and said, well, we can't find them. And he said, well, he said, I need them because I want to put this on IMAX. So long story short, Ron Howard had to resort to gathering old VHS videos of the Apollo missions and put that in his documentary to commemorate. But now from there, where are the tapes? Well, it turns out that all 14,000 reels of telemetry tapes, and the reel, by the way, back then, we're talking, you know, reel-to-reel tape on big computers. A reel is about the size of an average car steering wheel. That's how big one reel is. 14,000, and each reel has about 15 minutes of information. Very important information. You have 14,000 reels for the whole Apollo 11 mission has gone missing. How do you lose 14,000 reels of telemetry tape? And I might add one more thing here. It isn't just for Apollo 11. All of the missions, a total of 140,000 reels of telemetry tapes have gone missing. They actually went missing in the early 70s. I actually looked into this and researched this and realized and found out that it was NASA themselves that signed out all those telemetry tapes from the archives. That's all on record. We don't specifically know who, and those tapes have disappeared. You have to come to one conclusion. Those tapes were destroyed. And the reason why those tapes were destroyed, because that would have a lot of historical significance, definitely for historians anyway and researchers. But those tapes had to be destroyed because there was nothing on those tapes to show. And just looking at those tapes and listening to those tapes and realizing there's nothing there would have been proof positive that the Apollo missions did not happen. So they had to be destroyed.
Randy, it was just an accident. They filmed over them with home videos.
Yeah, very good point. So that's an argument that was always put forward to me until I politely remind them that that was in the 1980s. There was supposedly a tape shortage in the 1980s, magnetic tape shortage in the 1980s. So what does NASA do? Well, NASA takes its prized data from the Apollo mission, synthesizes the tape over it. Oh, very clever. Except there's one little problem. There's a little flaw in the proponent's argument on that. The tapes went missing in the 1970s where there was no tape shortage, not the 1980s where there was a tape shortage. So end of story.
There's an interesting movie on Apple, and I'm pleasantly surprised that Apple would show such a movie. I don't know if you've seen it. It came out last year. It's called Fly Me to the Moon, and it stars Channing Tatum, Woody Harrelson, Scarlett Johansson, and it's a moon landing story, but they actually entertain the idea that the whole thing was formed, and that was Woody Harrelson's character with Stanley Kubrick. Of course, they make out that it's all a clown show and that Woody Harrelson is nuts, but they actually entertain the idea, which for me is fascinating.
Yeah, I saw the movie. My wife and I, we saw the movie in the theater, actually, and she wanted to see it too because, of course, she knows my work and she's not biased, but she likes it. But I found what I actually a little disappointed in the movie because I know so much more about the subject, but it was a step in the right direction. And you're right. I find it very interesting that they put that fake part in there. Well, of course, the moon in the backdrop was that Apollo missions were really happening, but they don't know if they can get the actual live visual feed from the lunar surface, so they're going to fake it just to make sure that, you know, everything went according to plan. But I call that a kind of a limited hangout.
Yes.
And I thought Woody Harrelson was great in that. I mean, it was one of his best roles. Yeah, he was great. And I call that kind of a limited hangout where they were sort of, they're acknowledging that, well, we could have faked it. It's possible, wink, wink. So they're leaving that up to the viewer, but it was a step in the right direction.
No, but I mean, how are you going to get away with it? You know, on a mainstream network, you kind of have to plant a seed. I mean, I'm sure many people are talking about that movie.
Yeah, well, see, that gets into speculation. And I teamed up with an author a year ago from California. Her name is Robin Landry. And she contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book, a fiction book on the Apollo missions. And I kind of said no at first because I don't write fiction. Fiction is very difficult. And, you know, I think you kind of have to have some talent to do that. I respect the amount of work and the creativity that goes into it, but she talked me into it. And I developed some characters in the book, and I worked on the astronaut part. She worked on the other part outside of the astronaut part, you know, looking into the story. And I found out when I was writing the book that I was able to put all the knowledge I had gained and all my research. And we came out with a reasonable scenario as to how and why they faked the Apollo missions. So I had to change the names of the central characters in the book. You know, I didn't want any lawsuits or anything. So I changed all the characters' names. I changed a few little things, but I kept the Apollo missions itself because it's international. Anybody can use that. And we come up with a reasonable explanation. It's very long to go into, but it's very involved because you're talking about, Jeremy, you're talking about involving the mainstream media in this, mm-hmm. and they all had to be involved in this. And of course, you would have American intelligence agencies involved in this as well. And I want to add one other thing, and I really get fed up with people when I hear this, that there's third-party evidence that the Apollo missions were real, and they cite you know, China, India, Russia, they all knew about it. They would have known anything about it. They would have said something about it. Well, of course, they all knew about it. They all knew it was hoaxed. They all knew it was faked. Is it to their advantage to say anything about it? I would argue no, it's not to their advantage. And maybe if people realize how interconnected these governments are at an international level, they would understand more where I'm coming from on this.
Mm. That warehouse that was in the movie, the set, I mean, NASA denies that that ever existed.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, of course they're going to deny it. You know, NASA's going to come out kicking and screaming before they admit to anything. That's what NASA does. NASA is another political organization laced with occult overtones. I mean, they lie. They just lie. It's like if you watch a NASA news conference, it's bizarre. I mean, it's almost as if they do a ritual before the press conference and one after. It's really bizarre. But from my understanding, there are some places where I know Bart Sobrill mentioned one. There's also Flagstaff, Arizona, where they built a two square mile replica of the Apollo 11 landing site, and that was used probably to transform that into other areas of the moon where the mission supposedly landed. So it's really not that difficult to fake when you have the cooperation of the mainstream media. I mean, where did we get our information from back in 1969? Well, we got it from Walter Cronkite on CBS, right? At that time, we had no capability of seeing the rocket beyond 60 miles. It was out of camera range. And at that point, they were using graphics and cartoons. And we were told what was going on by the mainstream media via Walter Cronkite. And who's Walter Cronkite? Well, he's, of course, one of the most famous CBS anchormen, who was also CIA. So, you know, connect the dots, folks.
Let's talk about the lunar training. You know, there are a whole bunch of variables here. Like, they had to practice landing and taking off from the moon. you know, with the lunar module, etc. You had the astronauts practicing. Did they get injured? Did they know what they were getting into?
I think the astronauts, you see, here's another thing that people need to factor in. Look at the average age of the Apollo astronauts. We're looking at astronauts in their mid, late 30s, some in their early to mid 40s at the time of the Apollo missions. Does anybody have a problem with that? I do. You have the best fighter pilots you have are in their early 20s to mid 20s because they're young. Their bodies can withstand the elements and the forces put on them. Now, put an astronaut in that same situation. You want the youngest, fittest astronaut you can have in order to tolerate the elements of space. A fighter pilot goes through nothing compared to what you would go through in the vacuum of space with all the elements that you're faced, right? So I believe, and I use this as speculation in my book, my third book, I believe that they were recruited in their 30s and early 40s for the and for their rank as military pilots, because number one, they'd be easier to control. Number two, they knew. They knew, right? They knew before they signed on that this was what was going to happen. And, you know, they could have told them anything. You know, you're military, you're doing this for your country, we need to beat the Russians, so on and so forth, you know, that old line, right? So we need to beat the Russians to the moon type of thing. But I really strongly believe that they have dropped hints over the years themselves and let things slip out that all was not right within NASA and the Apollo program, most famous being Buzz Aldrin. I mean, he lets things slip left and right. I mean, the man, it's frustrating for the intelligence agencies to have to, you know, deal with Buzz Aldrin because he just lets things happen. No, we didn't go. Well, what was he famously said? He was asked, another astronaut, Alan Bean was asked, and I think it was by Bart Sabril actually, in a press conference, did you have any experience of going through the Van Allen belts? And he said, well, no, we didn't go out that far. And he was politely told, well, you had to have gone through the Van Allen belts, the radiation belts, to get to the moon. And he said, oh yeah, you're right. No, there was no effects. This is Alan Bean, okay? Apollo 12, I believe it was Apollo 12, who should have known that the most perilous part of that whole flight would have been going through the Van Allen belts. For those of you out there that don't know, the Van Allen belts are named after a scientist by the name of James Van Allen, and it's very intense radiation. Two belts, very intense radiation that surround the Earth, and you have to go through those intense radiation belts in order to get to the moon. All right? And those radiation belts have been formed there for millions, billions of years, and they've accumulated a lot of very intense radioactive particles. So you need a lot of shielding to get through that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was asking about the lunar training. So they had to also practice on that lunar module.
Yeah, so here's the thing about the lunar module. You're talking about the lunar training vehicle that they built on Earth. Yeah, so that was a lunar training vehicle that they built on Earth to simulate, to give the astronauts some practical training besides simulator training. So what's very interesting about that is that they spent 90% of their time flying that vehicle just to keep it in the air and 10% simulating what it would have been like to land a vehicle on the lunar surface. And it became so hazardous. Did you know that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, of course, the first two that landed on the moon, Buzz Aldrin never had any training whatsoever on a lunar landing training vehicle? What if there was had it been some kind of incident where Neil Armstrong was incapacitated, Buzz Aldrin would have had to take over. Yet he had no training on the lunar training landing vehicle. You know, so that was abandoned halfway through the Apollo missions because it was a disaster. It was a flying disaster. And there was a couple of crashes involved in the LT, in the lunar training vehicle. So NASA itself, and I document that in my second book, NASA itself said the program was ended while they were halfway through sending missions to the moon.
I heard that Neil Armstrong himself almost died.
Yeah. I'm not sure now if he was even flying that. I think that might have been just for PR.
Right.
I highly doubt that they would let their prized possession, he was selling the program, just his image was selling it. I highly doubt that they would have allowed him to even fly that. But to give the benefit of the doubt that there's a lot, anybody can go online and find that film. That video is online of him bailing out, some kind of an explosion. He bails out and parachutes to safety. And of course, the vehicle crashed into the ground. And it was shortly after that I think it was about a year after that, they ended that program.
Neil's an interesting one because he didn't ever really do interviews after the whole thing. I think he became like an alcoholic and a recluse.
Yeah. So I based my main character in my third book, I based my character on Neil Armstrong. And I always have a little, I always had an element of respect for Neil Armstrong. I really think that who knows why he was involved. Maybe he was compelled to be involved. He was the poster child for the Apollo missions. It's not something he wore very well. He didn't like his photo being taken on the lunar surface itself. You see the two of them jumping around, but you don't see any. You see a very prominent photo of Buzz Aldrin on the moon, but you don't see Neil Armstrong in any still photos. He refused to have his shot taken. That tells you a lot. Was he worried about anything liable happening to him? That's a very important point. And he rarely gave interviews. He worked basically. He resigned his commission after the Apollo missions. He went into teaching. He became a recluse. I mean, he gave an interview once every year or once every 2 years. And when he did, it was carefully choreographed and scripted. He would reluctantly attend, commemoration ceremonies, so on and so forth. But it was a very controlled, his exposure to the public was very controlled, and he wanted it that way. You would have thought that, okay, here's the first man to land on the moon. You would have thought that he would have been in every school, every high school, every college. Yeah, every university, jumping for joy, celebrating, trying to inspire people to get involved. Look what we did, rah, rah, rah. And it was none of that. It was the complete opposite. And if you look at the press conference that Apollo 11 crew gave 2 weeks after they landed, after they splashed down, it is the most depressing press conference I've ever seen. And yeah. I mean ever. It's just like you thought they would be jumping for joy
That's one of the things I've never understood. I mean, supposedly the greatest event in human history, and they don't look happy or excited, and they don't do interviews, and they become reclusive and all sorts of weird things.
Yeah. And I think, again, it gets into speculation, but I try to put myself in their shoes. Like I try to look at, well, what kind of pressure were they under? I do know they made a lot of money. They made a lot of money on the side, by using their brand, selling things, making commercials and things like that, and using their name to sell products. But take the third astronaut with the Apollo 11. You had, what is his name? Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and the other one escapes me right now. He loved it. He loved the limelight, but Neil Armstrong did not. Mm-hmm. And it tells me that he might have been coerced into participating in the Apollo missions and then wanted nothing to do with it. He did his part and got out. But there are a lot of strange behaviors. You have Buzz Aldrin, and I'm not mocking Buzz Aldrin for his alcoholism, but it is, you wonder, what he too was going through in all of this. And did that drive him to drink it? We all have alcoholism in our families, and it's nothing to make fun of. And I don't like it when we make fun, when my community does. The people I know personally haven't, but for those of you that want to make fun of Buzz Aldrin, don't. It's not funny. So I try to put myself in their shoes to see what it is they were going through, what drives a person to that mental and emotional state that they have to drink.
But
a lot of strange behavior.
On the day, Randy, there were a lot of people there. They saw the rocket. The rocket went up. What happened that day?
So I believe that, there was what, an estimate, what, two or 3 million people that were there to watch the launch of Apollo 11. And of course, CBS and Walter Cronkite was there with his commentary. And I strongly believe that there was no one on that rocket. Bart Sobrillo will disagree with me. I believe there was no one on that rocket. I do believe that they went through the motions. I talk about this. See, fiction's a great way to speculate. I speculate as to how they actually did it. That was, they couldn't take a chance on putting a crew on board that rocket. It was too dangerous.
And nobody would have known.
How would they?
Because, no, what I'm saying is, you're standing far away. You can't see if those three astronauts are actually walking into the module, or can you?
No, you can't. But you have close-up footage of them walking into the module, but we don't know what happened after that. And the cameras are so far away that they can't. So a lot of people don't know is that there was an escape chute from the Apollo capsule. So the astronauts could have easily gotten out or been helped out after the cameras left, because then there's that hour countdown, right? And there's an escape chute that goes from the top of the command module, the tower, down to a bunker that's 40, 50 feet underground, reinforced, that can withstand nothing short of a nuclear attack. And they would, in the case of an accident or in case of an incident, I don't know how they would get out of the rocket on time. There was an incident with one of the engines. But they would use the emergency escape chute down to that tunnel, and that bunker underneath the launch pad. There's a bunker right underneath the launch pad, 40, 50 feet under. And that bunker can sustain life for a full week. So I suspect that's a scenario. That's a scenario I use in my book, that after the cameras had left, then the astronauts were taken out of the rocket, and they were removed their spacesuits and slid down the chute, which is an actual fact. Anybody can YouTube this, and into the underground bunker, and they stay there until things settle down. That's my personal belief. I know there's other people that have their own speculation on this, but I do know, and I'm almost sure, there was no one on board Apollo 11 when it launched.
Yeah, I think Bart, I think he argues that they were on board, but they just went into orbit and then came back a few days later. Although, I mean, either way, the argument is that they didn't go. Yes, the thing though, how would anybody actually know? Because you can only look up so far. The rest of the trip, you'd have to rely on NASA.
Yeah, and this is, again, gets into some other interesting territory. You have NASA's now pushing the whole idea that there were amateur astronomers, that not only astronomers that work for companies that are funded by government. So of course they're going to say, yeah, we saw the spacecraft on the way to the moon. Look at our telescope here. We'll show you the photos. Well, of course, they're working for government-funded institutions. Of course they're going to promote the status quo and the official narrative. But now they're saying that there's amateur astronomers. It's interesting, though, how you never hear their names, or not much of their names anyway, in their backgrounds, and nobody took a photo. And now you also have ham radio operators said that they were picking up communications between NASA and Houston Control. I could tell you right now, if this had been a real mission, those they would have been using frequencies that were not accessible from ham radio operators. Those would have been classified. It would have been carefully scripted before it was released to the public. And same goes to the space shuttle. NASA lets you hear what they want you to hear. Okay, so I've pretty well debunked all of that nonsense as well. Nobody saw those missions. You wouldn't be able to tell. I can't tell a 707 from a 747 at 30,000 feet up, flying over. And it's a hell of a lot bigger than a spacecraft. I mean, the command module is about the size of an average car, small car.
I've read articles that say that the Saturn rocket that was used on the day was underpowered. Now, you said earlier that the Saturn V was the most powerful rocket. What's going on there?
So I said it was the most powerful rocket, according to NASA. I didn't say it was actually in reality. The Saturn V was underpowered. There was no way, in my opinion, that they could get. I think they were trying to get something out of the F1 engines. I believe there might have been some more than two launches, but unmanned missions of the F1 engines. I think there was another purpose for that. But I'm 95% sure they. When I say it was the most powerful rocket ever built, yes, NASA says it's the most powerful rocket ever built, but in practice, was it actually used? I believe no, it's not. I believe Bill Casing was right from the very start when they used the less powerful engines And people say, well, we heard the roar, you know, we were miles away and we heard the roar at launch. Well, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between an H1 roar and an F1 roar. One is a smaller engine, the other one's a larger engine. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the two. You would just, as an observer, as a layperson observer, hear the roar of the engines. And then NASA conditions your mind to believe that you're actually hearing the F1 engine. So yes, the most powerful rocket ever built. It's billed as the most powerful liquid fuel rocket ever built. It hasn't been anything like it since. They still have one or a couple on display. They should reverse engineer that engine because they're having problems with the new powerful one now. But that's another story. So when I say yes, the most powerful, that's on paper, but in practice, no.
Now, if somebody asks the question, okay, you claim that it's underpowered, but what are your metrics? What are you gauging it with?
So I talk about this in book two. Book one. There was a couple of Russian scientists. And see, here we go again. People say, well, the Russians had to know something about it. They would have said something about it. Well, here you have Russian scientists coming out, writing very extensive articles and describing why this engine didn't work. But they won't believe that. They need to hear it from Putin, I guess. They need to hear it from a politician before they believe it. But when a scientist comes out and says it, they don't want to listen. So I documented one Russian scientist who analyzed both the Apollo 4 launch of which was the Saturn V launch, and the second unmanned launch, which was Apollo 6, Saturn V launch. And he noticed Apollo 6 was plagued with problems, and he was able to determine by looking at film footage and photographs and looking at the technical design of the engine that they were having serious problems with the combustion chamber within the F1 engine, that it was very unstable. In fact, you have NASA engineers that have admitted that if there was a crew on board the second Saturn V launch, they would have either been killed or they would have abort anyway, the vibration from the disruption of the F1 engines not working properly was that bad. They would have had to abort or they might have been killed outright. So he does a 60-page article. I talk about it a lot. And he goes through all of the specifications and the technological aspect of the F1 engines, and he describes in detail why those engines failed. And as I said, they were having a problem with the combustion chamber of the F1 engines. Just to give your the audience a little bit of information here, the combustion chamber, inside the combustion chamber of the F1 engines, is what is called a controlled explosion. That's where you see the flame coming out the nozzle. So that controlled explosion reaches temperatures of about, 5,000, instead of getting into Fahrenheit and Celsius, half the temperature of the surface of the sun. Okay, so you're looking at probably 2,000 or 3,000.
Whatever.
5,000. Yeah. So you need to cool that down. You need to stabilize that because that kind of temperature is going to distort the combustion chamber. And if you have a distortion of the combustion chamber, you have an explosion of the engine and you lost the whole rocket. So they had to cool that down. It was that part that the scientists had determined was not working properly. The cooling system to keep those temperatures stable was not functioning properly. And that's what led to the near disaster of the launch of Apollo 6.
You touched on JFK earlier. Was there a link between his assassination and the Apollo mission?
So a month before JFK was assassinated, he had ordered NASA administrator at that time to meet with his counterpart in Russia, in the Russian space program. And he was seeking full cooperation with the Russians on a manned mission to the moon. In other words, what he was doing was he was laying the groundwork. He actually actually signed a memorandum to that effect, which is, again, it's in my second book. And he was laying the groundwork for open cooperation between the Russians and the Americans. Now, I say open because And people, I put that in a book. I don't think it was the sole reason why he was assassinated, but it was maybe a contributing factor because he was revealing a lot. But when I say open, I actually believe the Russians and the Americans were already working together on their respective space programs, and they were sharing information back and forth. Kennedy was talking about bringing that out in the open. That's the difference, and that's what I was talking about.
So in the 60s, they had a very tight deadline, basically the end of 1969. Assuming that everything you're saying is correct and they didn't go, could they have gone if they had more time?
No, not with this technology. This technology is, and some within my own community, research community might disagree with me on this, but my answer to that is a flat no. With the technology we have today, you cannot safely send manned missions through the radiation belt surrounding the Earth. Not to mention you have powerful coronal mass ejections and solar flares coming from the sun. Not to mention that you have micrometeorites as a potential hazard. Not to mention galactic cosmic rays, which come from outside the galaxy and are coming in constantly bombarding planets. That's why we have a magnetic field, because it deflects 95% of that. And anything else gets through the north and south poles, and it goes into orbit in our magnetic field, hence the radiation belts. So no, with present day technology, we cannot get through the Van Allen belts. I'm not talking about unmanned missions. I'm talking about manned missions specifically. When they talk about a mission to the moon, it's not going to happen. NASA's now projected its schedule to work by 2030. They want to have regular flights back, manned missions back and forth to the moon. It's not going to happen. In fact, I will add that NASA Inspector General has himself come out and said that the schedule for NASA today is unrealistic. So they're already laying the groundwork to cancel these flights.
Which means that nobody's going to go to Mars either.
Fairy tale. You'll read it in a book. You'll have much more fun.
Hopium. But
it's a fairy tale.
It's all hopium.
Yeah. Yeah, for the masses. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's opium for the masses. And I think a lot of people are now coming around to that realization. And a lot of people are now seeing that for what it is. I mean, it's interesting now that the numbers of people who believe the Apollo missions were faked has gone up a lot. Mm. And in Britain, I think it's over 50-60%.
There is a lot to cover, Randy. We've only spoken about the pre-missions effectively. And we could go on for hours, but your books contain a lot more. Where can I get them?
The books are available on Amazon.com. All three books are available on Amazon.com.
They're called again?
So the first one is called The Apollo Moon Missions, Hiding a Hoax in Plain Sight, Part 1. And then there's Part 2 to that as well. And then my latest book is The Apollo Moon Missions, my latest book is... I've got somebody, Apollo, The Real Mission, and that was co-written by Robin Landry. And I just want to add something that Robin, I would just want to publicly thank Robin Landry, because I didn't think I could do fiction. And she was very helpful with me on that. She's a very, very, she's a phenomenal fictional writer herself. And she's very much in tune with what you and I are talking about. So she was the perfect person to do this. So, you know, they're all available online. And you can also, I want to just, there's a YouTube channel. He actually takes my videos and he puts them on, edits them. But for those of you out there, the Apollo Detectives YouTube channel has all the information you require. He has a lot of people like myself on there. It's not my channel. It's his channel. He likes the work we're doing. Marcus Allen from Nexus Magazine, he's on there. And you get a lot of information. If you want to do some catching up on that, that's your go-to channel, your go-to source. So I highly recommend that channel for people that want to actually, who don't want to read the books, but maybe want to go to the channel. So, you know, everybody has their preferred format.
Randy Walsh, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
It was a pleasure, Jerm. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.